Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. In a state that ranks near the bottom in measures of overall health, Oklahoma has shown a few bright spots in some health domains. Notable among them is mental health. As one of the states with the lowest per capita spending for mental health, it's no surprise that in 2006, the National Alliance on Mental Illness gave Oklahoma a letter grade of D for its mental health services. However, a mere 3 years later, Oklahoma had improved to a B ranking through the use of drug and mental health courts and more investment in planning from the Oklahoma Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services. Here in Tulsa, we're blessed with a variety of mental health service providers, including Family and Children's Services, the Mental Health Association of Tulsa, and specific programs like the Women in Recovery program that we've also explored on this program. One of the lesser-known resources is the Tulsa Center for Behavioral Health, a state-funded inpatient facility that's been providing interdisciplinary and wraparound services to both acute and chronic mentally ill patients for more than a decade. My guest today, Leah Price, is the executive director of the Tulsa Center for Behavioral Health. She has 2 decades of experience treating both adult and children acute and chronically mentally ill, and she's been at the helm of TCBH for 7 years. In our conversation today, she gives superb insight into the state of mental health in Oklahoma and shares both her personal journey into the mental health field and innovations in mental health treatment. She's our guest today in studio at Studio Tulsa on Health. Leah Price, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me.
I want to start by asking you what the scope of TCBH, Tulsa Center for Behavioral Health, is. What kind of patients? How many patients can you serve at a time?
The Tulsa Center for Behavioral Health is a 56-bed inpatient psychiatric facility. We serve adults only and male and female from 18 to end of life, basically. We only provide inpatient services for folks who are in mental health and or substance abuse crisis, where I would describe us as a short-term stabilization and treatment facility. We stabilize, provide a safe environment for people who have some risk of dangerousness to themselves or others, and we stabilize them, and then we do a very good job at hooking them back up to their outpatient providers so that they can continue in their recovery and go back to their outpatient services.
So is TCBH like a state mental institution used to be, or how is it different? And you mentioned short term. I guess that's one of the keys.
Yes. Basically, inpatient treatment these days tends to be fairly short term. Resources have shrunk over the years. Methods of treatment have improved. Recognition that taking people out of their natural environments for long periods of time is not necessarily the best way to approach treatment and recovery. So no, we're not the way things used to be in the past. Our average length of stay is only about 14 days, but really, we have a lot of people who stay even shorter than that, and then we have some who need to stay a little longer. We focus very much in keeping people as much as possible in their natural environment. That means close to home, close to their families, their support networks. If they can be treated on an outpatient basis, then that certainly is the priority. It's only when they cannot, when all of those other types of things have been tried and exhausted, that we look at placing someone into an inpatient setting.
And where do your inpatients get referred to you from? Is it mostly from hospital emergency departments?
Some are, although not all of them by any means. About 50% of our consumers come in as voluntary patients. So that means that they may just walk in our front door requesting services and feeling like they're in some kind of crisis and they need help. Some are brought in by families and friends and those in the community. And the other 50% come to us as involuntary. And that can mean that the police have come into contact with them for some reason out in the community or in their neighborhoods and in their homes. That can mean that the court has come in contact with them, that a family member or someone close to them has requested an evaluation for their mental health needs, and then the sheriffs would bring them to us. But we see all kinds of people for all kinds of reasons.
What's the history of TCBH? That is, when did it start? And
TCBH has been around as far as being a state-owned and operated facility for about 10 years now. We not long back had our 10th anniversary. Prior to that, crisis services were handled by contract agencies with the department. But we are a state-owned and operated facility. The department has multiple facilities like that, and then they also have many others that they contract with. They're private nonprofits that they contract with. And so 10 years.
The folks that work at the Tulsa Center for Behavioral Health? Are they mostly psychologists, social workers? What types of backgrounds do the folks that work there have?
We have many different disciplines that work at TCBH. We have psychiatrists are our main doctor staff. We do not have a lot of psychologists. We actually have a contract psychologist that we can access for psychological testing if we require it. But we have psychiatrists. We, of course, have nurses that lead our units. We have staff that are known as PCAs, patient care assistants, and we also have CRSs, consumer recovery specialists, and they are our where the rubber meets the road stuff. They help take care of the practical needs of the consumers while they're with us. So they do everything from running some groups to helping assist people with their daily living type things like showers, to moving them around the facility, escorting them, supervising visitation, things like that. Then we have clinicians who are a mixture of licensed and master's level folks who are assigned, one clinician is assigned to each patient, and they do those inpatient social work kinds of needs, help take care of those. We have recreational therapy services for our consumers. We have other bachelor's, master's, license level mixture of folks who man the triage department. They're our front door who, when someone comes in for an evaluation, they do the evaluation piece to determine whether they meet criteria for admission or whether they could be better served by being referred back out to somewhere else in the community. So we have a mixture.
Do you ever get a brand new patient? I mean, someone who has never been diagnosed with mental illness who walks in the front door and I guess is having a psychotic break, for example?
Absolutely. That's probably the other way that you could distinguish or separate our clients into groups. We see a lot of people who have been dealing with mental illness for a long period of time and they've been in treatment. We also see others for the very first time. In fact, I'd say in recent times, we see an increasing number of first-time people, or at least first-time to us. One of my groups of people that I really, that affect me and are close to my heart are those first-time break young people. Commonly, they're young men who are in their late teens to middle 20s, and they may be dealing with a first psychotic break, and it's very difficult. It's extremely scary for them, extremely scary for their family, and they just have no frame of reference. They very much tend to be in denial. They're often have been self-medicating, so there's substance abuse issues going on as well because they've been trying to deal with symptoms as they've crept up on them without knowing what was going on. So I think in the recent few years, with all of our financial, budgetary type and economic crises that the community's been experiencing, I think we've seen a lot of people who have had increased stressors. And for those reasons, for family stress reasons, for job opportunities decreasing maybe, things like that, some of them have either lost insurance because we often see people who don't have insurance coverage, or just because things have just got tougher and people are really struggling to cope and we're seeing them have a first-time crisis.
You mentioned substance abuse as folks self-medicating to try to cope with some of the mental illness that may be a first-time occurrence for them. How often does substance abuse coexist with mental illness in the population that you serve?
I believe that it coexists a lot. At work, we sometimes say, let's just assume that it's 100% of the time. And of course, that varies in intensity. But I believe that, I can't quote this as a number from a book, but I think 70 to 80% of the time that you could well be looking at some degree of substance abuse co-occurring with mental illness. It doesn't mean that those people, all 80% of those people are addicted to substances, but they've maybe abusing substances or using them in an effort to self-medicate or have some history of it. And sometimes it's really hard. It takes a lot of searching through people's story to even try to figure out what came first, whether substance abuse issues were there first, which led to some further mental illness issues, or whether it was the other way around. Recent methods of treatment and philosophies of treatment say that it really doesn't matter what came first. We try to look at addressing substance abuse and mental health issues as they exist together. It's called kind of co-occurring disorders, and we try to provide treatment for both.
Are there new forms of treatment? What are the newest forms besides, we think of, the stereotypic types of things from, say, the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest movie of electroshock therapy or Thorazine injections. I know there are many newer oral medications and other types of therapies.
Yes. We have a lot of newer medications, new ones coming out all the time, it seems. Some medications, or many of them, are oral, but we also have new injectables, which the advantage of those is that they're long-acting, which means that folks, instead of having to remember to take medication every day or multiple times a day, may receive an injection once a month or once every few weeks, which I don't know about you, but I have trouble remembering to take an antibiotic for 10 days. If I had to take medicine every day, I know I would miss doses. So this is a very useful way that folks can do their medication. And then we have all other kinds, many different other kinds of interventions. We have PAC teams, three of those in Tulsa, actually. And these are intensive wraparound service teams that work with, they all have different caseloads, but they work with a smaller number of people, but they provide very intensive services. And that can mean everything from seeing a patient every day to drop off meds and make sure someone's getting their meds, to seeing them once or twice a week to provide support services as they get further into their recovery and they need less. And folks can belong to a PAC team forever. They don't. It's not like you get to a certain degree of wellness and then you can't have that service anymore. You can kind of keep stay on with a PAC team and continue and to be in recovery. Many people will have heard of some of the newer things, like we have drug courts and we have mental health courts, which are diverting people out of prison for different reasons. We have wraparound services for children and families, where we're looking at families holistically, not just that a kid has a problem, and we're trying to provide support and services to the entire family, which in turn obviously affects the mental health of the child. There's many, many things that are happening now, which have just been great steps forward for treating mental illness.
So those do sound like more holistic programs, very interdisciplinary, and focusing on the family as a unit rather than just on, say, the individual client or patient. In this very, as you alluded to, the very tough economic climate, in addition to sort of state and federal budgets being cut, and we're in a period of sequestration now from the federal government, is that, how does that impact TCBH or the mental health community in general?
The last years have been tough, and we've the Department of Mental Health has taken, along with most other state agencies, taken significant cuts. The last year or two, we've finally seemed to have maybe plateaued a little bit and not had to have further cuts, and I'm really glad about that. I know the department's emphasis has been on, as we've looked at those cuts and tried to absorb those cuts, has been on trying to minimize any decrease in services to people. We have looked at our administrative overhead. We've tried to, you know, really pare that down. We all are probably doing more with less. You know, some we've had to probably look very carefully at our staffing and, you know, what positions we have. But the commissioner has a great commitment to maintaining the level of services that we can. And that's really important because we still don't have enough services. Mental health services are not getting out to every Oklahoman who needs them. And we've not wanted to decrease those, you know, in any way more than we have to. So we work lean. At TCBH, we're not fancy, but we have good people with lots of experience. We try to provide a great environment of, you know, care and support for people, and we try to keep services to the maximum services to the maximum number of people that we can.
When you look at numbers or demographics, I mean, how many, the state population of Oklahoma is, I think, 3.2 million. How many chronically mentally ill patients are there in Oklahoma?
The numbers I have are that there are about 620,000 folks suffering with mental illness in Oklahoma, and about 146,000 of those you would consider to have serious mental illness. It's a large number, and unfortunately, the same statistics I have say that we're probably not reaching 70% of those who need the services.
Goodness. So, but if I do the math quick in my head, I mean, about 20% of the population, you're saying, has some form of mental illness.
Yes, Oklahoma scores fairly high. On national surveys that talk about who has, you know, severe mental health issues by state, we're at one of the lower states. We're far now down near the bottom, unfortunately.
And you mentioned, again, the economic malaise of the last few years is having a dislocating effect. Is that, I'm sure, your perception, but is there a way to sort of reliably know that? In other words, do you see more volume at TCBH or more demand for your triage services, or do you have a way of doing a census, as it were, on the mental health population, just say in Tulsa, the city or the county?
We of course keep numbers of people that come in through the front door that we evaluate. The numbers have, I'm not sure that the numbers have increased excessively overall, you know, by year, by total per year, but our beds are full now all of the time, and we are sending people to other facilities for treatment. We can't even keep up with the demand in Tulsa. So while our number, you know, when you get to 100%, those extra folks end up showing up on somebody else's census. But unfortunately, we're having to send people to other state facilities around the state when we don't have beds. Our beds are staying full, like I said, 100% of the time. I think what we've seen happen is an increase in acuity. We serve very, very sick folks who are at a point in crisis. They're very, very sick. And sometimes they respond to interventions really quickly, and we can, you know, turn that around. But we seem to be seeing an increasing number that take a little bit longer. And certainly we see people that come back for further episodes of treatment. So I really don't know the answer to statistically. I just know that we don't have a spare piece of space anywhere. We're treating folks in every bed we have.
So, and you mentioned the 56 beds. If you could snap your fingers, would you increase the number of beds, or would that, I mean, in a wild fantasy, would you want to have more capacity to meet the needs of the community?
Okay, so certainly I might not be the expert about this, but my opinion, I think that we probably could use some more beds, but I do want people to hear that I don't think that's the total answer. Treating people in inpatient, it's an artificial environment. It is, you know, taking them away from their home and their family. It is not something you do lightly. And there are certain, you know, there are drawbacks to that. It's not a natural environment. What I think the department would say is that we would focus any extra money, or if, you know, if we had more money, certainly the focus should be on prevention and early intervention. The sooner that we can get to kids or young people or adults, the sooner we can get to them. It's like with any illness. If you treat it early and catch it quickly and do that, it's much a cheaper thing to do, and it's more effective for the person, and it makes recovery easier. When things are left untreated and time goes by and, you know, things get worse, then of course it is harder for the person. It impedes, you know, getting folks back on track. It's a more expensive intervention. So yes, it would be wonderful to have more services. Would I put them all into inpatient beds? No.
How prevalent is violence in the clients you serve in terms of either domestic violence where they are in abusive relationships, or where, you know, some of the patients themselves may have committed violence? You mentioned the mental health courts. So I assume some of the folks you serve are remanded to DCBH, as it were?
Yes. When I talk about court, though, the court that we deal with is a civil commitment court, not a criminal. The mental health court program is criminal mental health. They only work with folks, though, I think, that have certain types of offenses, and I believe not necessarily violent offenses. Although I'm not expert, I don't work for that program. But I think there's a perception out in the world that mentally ill people, you know, are very violent. And we certainly hear about those sensational cases on the news, unfortunately, on a regular basis, it seems. Those are very sensational cases. They're very extreme. And unfortunately, they get talked about over and over and over. And I think that helps with that perception that, you know, all mentally people are violent and dangerous, and we have to be very careful about that. It's not really the case. Certainly people in crisis can exhibit some acting out or some violent behavior, but I don't believe that that's the majority at all of the mentally ill that we serve. Most folks are in a really bad place. They want help even if they can't ask for it, and they don't hurt anybody else. And I've worked for the department now for close to 20 years, and that's just been my experience in all the different areas that I've worked in, all, you know, inpatient and outpatient. You know, we can have incidences where folks, and I think more so it's about agitation, and that's about not being able to communicate, and it's about not being able to kind of perceive the world clearly, and confusion. And we have interventions on how to help people with that, and we move on, and usually it's very short-lived.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today is Leah Price, Executive Director of the Tulsa Center for Behavioral Health. And we're talking about the association between mental illness and violence. And so would you say that the public's fear of the mentally ill is unfounded, essentially? I mean, you're talking about 20 years of experience where you've seen very little in the way of violence from mentally ill.
It depends what you're talking about, John. When you're talking about someone in crisis, then I think there's a need for alertness, because you're not talking about someone who's processing in a normal way. And I tell the folks I work with that all the time, new staff. We work in an environment where you need to be alert and aware of your environment and your surroundings and the people in them, but we don't need to be fearful. I think that in the public arena, folks don't understand mental illness. They don't necessarily have much experience with it. And so, yeah, I could see why it would seem to be scary and someone's behavior might seem to be scary. Are there mentally ill people out roaming the streets, you know, looking for people to hurt? No, I don't believe that, you know, in mass. You know, I don't believe that. I think that the more we can educate people about mental illness and reduce stigma, the better off we will be. The more, you know, the more tolerance we have for folks who are a little different from us and who are suffering with an illness, the better off we will be. That's what I would wish for.
So 20 years in service to the community, has stigmatization of the mentally ill changed at all? Have you seen it diminish?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're moving in the right direction. Are we there? No. You know, it still exists. Again, ignorance and lack of tolerance, it's a hard thing to totally overcome. But I think there's so much more information out there now. We are, you know, we do get media coverage in different ways. There are organizations, you know, grassroots advocacy organizations that are busily educating people and, you know, being able to talk about things. And I think our world is just a little more open about a lot of things, you know, progressively as the years go by. So I think it has changed. Should we keep working at it? Should we keep on with those things? Absolutely.
How did you come to the mental health field? You seem very committed and passionate about it. What was your, how did you find out about it?
I started straight from school. I went to college to complete a social work degree. So social services field was my interest from the beginning. And that was a long time ago and in Australia. And then I worked as a youth worker. Started my commitment in the beginning was to kids. Always loved working with kids and wanted to do that forever. When I came to live in the U.S., I started looking for a job and was lucky enough to get a job with the Department of Mental Health. And it was on the clinical side. It was on the social work side. And I worked with kids. After a couple of years, I was given an opportunity to move into administration. And by that time, I was middle 30s maybe and had already been starting to think about maybe I had an interest in that area. And so I took the opportunity I was given and I moved into administration. And since then, I've done more administrative jobs. But I never wanted to be an administrator at a trucking company. I always wanted to do it in the social services field because that's kind of where my heart's just always been. So I continued and I've been able to stay with the Department of Mental Health, but work in, maybe five or six different positions, different capacities. And I've kind of out of necessity, I moved away from kids and into the adult side and have been doing that for the last 10 or so. I just enjoy, you know, I think every social worker of any kind would tell you they do it because they want to help people. You know, you get into something like that because you want to help people. I enjoy what I do. There's never a dull moment. Every day is a little bit different. I get to impact people, I think, in a big way. And I get to impact people that, in general, are not well treated possibly anywhere else in their life. And so for me, that's a bit more of a calling than it is a job. And I'm just really glad to be able to do that. And, you know, that's the kind of people I work with every day. So it's kind of a neat environment to work.
You grew up in Australia.
Yes, I did.
And was it in your parents or what do you think inculcated the social values to you that made you concern for other people?
Education was really big with my parents. Not so much social services type work, but education. And so for a long time growing up, I thought I'd be a teacher and then changed my mind as I was graduating from high school. I just remember I always liked kids, always wanted to work with kids and wanted to help kids. My mum actually said, "You'll never be a social worker because you're too soft-hearted." And if she was here, and she's not, she's passed on now, but if she was here, I'd say, "Well, what do you think?" You know, 30 years later or whatever. But it was just something I remember volunteering with kids at an orphanage type place in Australia when I was kind of in the 11th grade. I mean, I just always wanted to do that. So that's kind of what got me in. Worked with homeless kids, street kids in Australia, then came over here, started working with junior high kids who had family issues and substance abuse kind of prevention work, and then kind of just into more mental health, straight mental health, and with the department. And then into adults. So it's just something that I like to do, and I think I have something to bring to it. I think I offer some sort of strengths for that, and that's what I do.
You mentioned homeless youth, and I'm curious, does the 20-year span of your work here in Oklahoma include when the state hospitals were deinstitutionalized, or did that predate you?
No, that's before me. That's pretty much the 60s you're talking about, deinstitutionalization? Yeah.
Yeah. What percent of your of the folks you see at TCBH are at any given time homeless, don't have a, you know, a home they can call their own or an address?
We don't keep I'm sorry, I don't have that statistic to give you. The department does keep some statistics on homelessness, but those are sort of computer, and I would have to get those from Oklahoma City. But every day we have someone who presents and tells us that they're homeless, whether that's actually on the street or in one of our local shelters, or whether that's living couch to friend to wherever they can find, you know, a shelter for the night. It's certainly not all of our all of our consumers, but every day we have some of those.
And do you see the so-called homeless problem in Oklahoma or in the U.S. as really a reflection of the fact that we have inadequate mental health services, by and large?
That would be, in my opinion, that would be too broad a generalization to make. Certainly, we have homeless people who have mental illness, and there have been lots of treatment interventions, you know, to target that population and try to help that population. I think that, but you know, we have homeless people who are certainly not mentally ill. I think that, like any, I think homelessness left untreated is going to result in a lot of negative impacting, you know, on someone's life. Homelessness would be one of those, could be one of those, as would lack of attention to medical problems, as would family disintegration, and that loss of support network. So I think you can't say homelessness is because of mental illness, but the two certainly are in relationship, and you know, we have significant number of homeless people that would have mental health issues.
Are there innovative programs you've seen from your reading or across the country or your peer network in terms of the so-called housing first approach?
That's one of the things I love about Tulsa. You know, the Mental Health Association is doing an amazing job with that. I don't feel qualified to talk about it except to say that I love the idea. I think that if we can provide a safe, secure home base for people, it's got to help with everything else. I mean, I know how would you and I feel if we didn't have, you know, our home to go home to, you know, every day. So I don't know that I know enough to know. I know there's a distinction between housing first and doing other kinds of interventions that then we get around to housing, and I'm not expert enough to distinguish between those. But, you know, here in Tulsa, we are so lucky to have MHAT has, you know, multiple different locations where they can house people. I love the idea that those housing complexes aren't just necessarily for the mentally ill or any one type of person, but they are for a variety of people. It's a much more natural, normal environment, just like any street or neighborhood. But they certainly do have places for the mentally ill. They provide support. We've got support services in there as well, because I think just providing the roof isn't enough. Certainly for some people. And so we've got, they work in conjunction with PAC teams, with case management service, with wraparound type services, so that we've got the support things happening for people to, so that they can maintain their housing. I love it. I think it's great.
Leah Price, we're almost out of time. I wanted to say I've really enjoyed talking to you and learning about mental health in Tulsa and in the United States. I think you have so much to offer, and your passion clearly shows through. So thank you so much for coming down.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the chance.
Leah Price is the executive director of the Tulsa Center for Behavioral Health. Well, that's our show for today. Our show is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views expressed on Studio Tulsa are those of our guests and commentators and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our recent shows, you can find them online at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for the Studio Tulsa link under the Programs tab. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.